Our fourth and final installment in our contemplation of the Buddha's teaching on not self. And it is one of the aspects of the realm of the Buddha's teaching that most notably distinguishes it from other major religious traditions, other major wisdom traditions. That and the fact that it is non-theistic. Most of the other major religious traditions of the world have a deity, you know, a supreme deity of some kind or another. And in Buddha Dharma, there is neither the positing of an external, omniscient, omnipotent supreme being, nor is there the positing of a permanent and abiding self. And so those are among the things that really most noticeably distinguish Buddha Dharma from the other great wisdom traditions, which is also one of the reasons why there's some diversity of view among religious scholars as to whether or not Buddhism is a religion. You know, there ain't no God, there ain't no soul, and you know, what you got? Is it just some sort of an interesting philosophy instead? It is a way of understanding the nature of mind, whether you choose to call it a religion or not. You know, there are aspects of it that certainly have all the trappings of religion, especially in the more traditional practices. And there are the other aspects of it that really invite one to consider ourselves, our nature, our relationship to the rest of the world in ways that don't quite necessarily line up with what one traditionally thinks of religion in the Western sense. And this realm of anatta, of not self, is one of those that is sufficiently distinguishing from other traditions that occasionally gives rise to this question, you know, is, do we really have a religion going on here or not? What we don't have, for the most part, as the Buddha instructed, is a belief system, which many other religions do have. Buddha was not real big on belief systems. What the Buddha was big on was contemplating an idea or a concept or a way of thinking about things, and then seeking to verify that view or that understanding with your own experience. And if based on your experience of working with or contemplating or looking at the world through that particular lens, it rings true, it feels like to you, yes, that feels to me like how things really are, okay. Then that begins to become your path. Path of practice, path of inquiry, okay. Because what has begun to shift a little is your understanding of your own consciousness, your understanding of your own nature and the nature of us all. And that shift in understanding can have, as a result, in terms of how we speak and how we act and how we treat each other, the very same kinds of transformations, the very same kind of fruition that one gets from other religious traditions. Okay. The Buddha was having a dialogue once, and I spoke a couple of meetings ago about this dialogue with a student, Subha, who is a Brahmin, a student of Brahmanism. He was training to be a Brahmin priest and scholar. And in so doing, he was trying to elicit from the Buddha, well, what's the difference between the Dharma that you teach and the Dharma that's taught by the Brahmins, right? And so the Buddha asked Subha to tell him a little bit about Brahmanism. And he did, and talked about some of the virtues that they seek to adhere to, that they seek to practice. And he said, yes, that's very good. I call that training of the mind. That's no problem there. What's the fruition of it? You know, what happens as a result? And that's where things got interesting, because evidently what was going on with Brahmanism and the Indian caste system at the time was that it was a little bit like the Catholic Church right before the Reformation. So the Brahmins were wealthy and they had a lot of authority in society, and they preached this doctrine of reincarnation, transmigration of self from being to being, and purification until you became one with Brahman. And then, of course, among the means, the good works that you would do is giving a lot of money to the Brahmins, right? So it's kind of self-reinforcing flavor to it. And so Buddha said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the teachings for the most part, but you really need to look to see if they're having the desired effect. And what Subha had to say was, well, you know, not so much. There aren't too many of my teachers that I would say are doing a very good job of actually living the precepts that they teach. And so then what the Buddha said was very, you know, bore a lot in common with what Jesus of Nazareth said, which was, by their fruit shall you know them, you know. What effect does this teaching or this way of seeing the world have on the way that people treat each other, you know? And that's, and so in that regard, in terms of fruition, in terms of outcome, Buddha Dharma has actually quite a lot in common with the other major world traditions. Sort of how you get there, how you get to that point, that's different. So, in the teaching of the Buddha, his most dramatic departure from Brahmanism, where they talk about the union of Brahman, the deity, and Atman, one's soul, eternal soul, was his teaching of Anatman, which is not self. Okay. And those words are used with a lot of care among Buddhist scholars, especially Theravadan scholars, because sometimes Anatman is treated as no self, right? But in the Buddhist time, there are these different schools of philosophy, one mostly emanating from Brahmanism called eternalism, which is that there is this eternal soul that transmigrates, you know, through lifetime after lifetime, this process of purification. Okay. And then there is this other group called the nihilists that said, nope, you die, that's it, you know, so it doesn't really matter how you behave in this lifetime because there's no payback. You know, you just live your life and then you're poof, and that's the end of the story. And so he was very careful with his languaging, and ever since that's been the case as well. Because he basically said, either the doctrine of a permanent and abiding self or the doctrine of no self. Okay, they're both doctrines. And at least in my experience, they don't comport with my own experience of how the mind works. Okay. And he said, in my experience of how the mind works, what the mind does a good deal of the time is to fabricate a sense of self. So when the mind is fabricating a sense of self, there's a self. And when the mind is not fabricating a sense of self, there's no self. Okay. So one of the scholars in this tradition, Thanissara Bhikkhu, wrote a little essay one time called The Not-Self Strategy. And so he said, yeah, instead of glomming on to one of these concepts or beliefs as if, well, this is how it really is, he said, try playing with this idea of not self as a strategy, as skillful means. Try the idea on for size. Okay. And then as you watch the mind, whether it's in meditation or in daily life or whatever, see if this teaching may have a little bit of relevance for you. You know. So he said, that which we tend to think of as the permanent abiding self, he said, it's this moment-to-moment fabrication, and it's made up of things like the body and the body's sensory apparatus, and the sensory apparatus's response to stimuli, and the identification of the stimulus as this, that, or the other thing, and the consciousness of the fact that all this is going on, and the dredging up of memories and reflections and all of our past experiences associated with what the mind is sensing, okay? So these five elements that then are kind of come together to form the self based upon the mind's desire for things to be different than they are. Okay. So, the mind may crave something that you don't have now that you want. The mind may crave things to be different than they are. Okay. The mind may be trying real hard to not see something that's right in front of you. Okay. So, what the Buddha says is, and you know, this in part has to do just with our hard wiring, having to do with our own survival, right? So, when we perceive phenomena, the first thing that the mind does very, very quickly, instantaneously, is to judge whether a sensory stimulus is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Does it represent a potential threat? Does it represent a potential opportunity? Or is it basically not relevant, period, you know? So the mind does this very rapid judging thing, right? So, and to some extent, it's really helpful, otherwise we wouldn't be here as a species, you know? But the mind can get kind of carried away with that, so that the mind is in a perpetual state of judging things to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? And in Buddhist psychology, what happens actually is that habits of mind develop, and one or another of those tendencies of mind comes to dominate, right? So you may tend to, if you're what the, you know, it's called a greedy type, you know, you may be constantly scanning for opportunities. What do I want? What do I see that I want? You know, how can it make me better off than I am now? You may be scanning, constantly scanning the environment for threats, you know, seeing perceived issues or problems with what's going on. You may be trying to block out as much of the environment as possible. So what the Buddha said is that when the mind is imbued with attachment, aversion, or delusion, it fabricates self. That if you perceive something to be a threat, you become a threatened person. The mind brings the self into being in a state of alarm or concern or anxiety or anger or whatever. Okay. If you're feeling needy, whether it's for food or drink or companionship or whatever, and you're scanning the environment all, or a job, you know, or a place to live, if you're feeling real deep need, you're always scanning the environment to fulfill that need. And you become, you bring into being a person in a state of need. So the fabrication of self happens from these energies of attachment, aversion, or delusion. Yeah?
Can you just go back a sentence or two? You said attachment, aversion, and delusion, the mind will create what?
It brings into being the self.
Yes.
It fabricates the self out of the you know, the sensory stimuli in the environment in order to meet the unmet need, or in order to protect oneself from the perceived threat. Okay. So what the Buddha taught is that when the mind is imbued with attachment, aversion, or delusion, essentially you fabricate a self whose mind state is dominated by that, and you speak and act accordingly, and you cause harm to yourself and others. You generate negative karma. Okay. So what the Buddha taught was last time we were together, I talked not only about these five components, you know, the five aggregates affected by clinging, but also the mechanism by which the mind pulls these things together and creates a sense of self. In other words, when it's feeling threatened, when it's feeling needy, then it takes these aggregates and fashions a sense of self that wants to meet the unmet need, that wants to avoid the perceived threat, or that just wants to make the world go away. Hence, we suffer. So the Buddha said, in order to be able to become free of that kind of suffering, we have to understand how the mind goes about fabricating the suffering self. Okay. And so that's where this notion of the Eightfold Path comes from. You know, each of the spokes on the Dharma wheel here representing one of them. The first three factors, the meditative factors of developing mindfulness and concentration and skillful effort, okay? When you do those things, it's like creating fertile ground for the arising of insight when the mind is really clear and focused and your effort is being skillfully used, then you can develop insight, which is why we call it insight meditation. You can develop insight into all the causes and conditions that gave rise to you being who you are in this moment in time. Okay. So you can see, you know, if you find yourself oftentimes feeling anxious or afraid or angry or whatnot, or oftentimes feeling, you know, particularly needy, what are some of the things that went into your life experience that resulted in you feeling that way now? And so it's called right understanding, your right view. Not right versus wrong, but right versus insightful. You know, right as useful, as being able to understand yourself better. And then the better you can understand yourself, the better you can understand your own motivations and intentions. So when you're getting ready to speak, when you're getting ready to do something, at that moment of intention, says the Buddha, when he's talking about the self-fabrication process, what's going on in the mind is that the mind is getting ready to give birth to the self. And if the mind is imbued with attachment or aversion or delusion, you're going to give birth to a self that acts out of that mind state and creates rough karma, as a result, creates suffering for yourself and others. If, as you are getting ready to speak or act, okay, and you can reflect on your motivations, are they based on attachment, aversion, delusion, or are they based, at least mostly, on generosity and kindness and wisdom? And essentially, the Buddha's teaching on this point was pretty simple. Said, if you can train the mind to understand what's going on in the moment before you speak or act, and recognize what your motivation is, that's the point at which you can either avoid creating negative karma or perhaps create beneficial outcomes. Okay. So what I wanted to spend a little time focusing on this evening, you know, we're looking at this model in kind of theoretical terms, you know, this concept, this idea. What does it really mean to live one's life from the standpoint of anatta in daily life? Not just as a mental construct, not just as an idea, but as your lived reality. Okay. And that is, that's a really worthy topic. Because you might wonder, is it even possible to live one's life from this perspective or this view of not-self? And the answer, of course, is yes. The Buddha said that's the path to freedom from dukkha, from freedom from suffering. Okay, is learning how to live a life that does not involve ceaselessly creating more negative karma. Okay, waking up to the times when you know the mind is imbued with anger or aversion or fear or restlessness or worry, anxiety. Okay. And if you can recognize the mind state before you act on it, then in that moment you become free of the effects of what acting on that state of mind would have done for you and what it would have done for others. It's an interesting realm. You know, there's one of the ways Buddha Dharma is often misunderstood is this idea that, well, the self's a real bummer, right? So we should do everything possible and not create in the first place. And so what we do is develop a self-aversive attitude to self, right? Doesn't work, believe me. I can tell you from 40 years of experience, it doesn't work, right? But we keep trying anyway, don't we? that his psychiatrist, Jack Engler, who's also a Dharma teacher, he said one of his better known quotes is, in order to be nobody, you have to be somebody. And what he meant by that was that in the evolutionary stages of spiritual maturation, having a positive regard for oneself, positive sense of self, is actually really pretty important. And to some extent, the Buddha, in his own time, said something along those lines in his own in different words, but with, I think, perhaps the same intention. Because he said, you know, if you are constantly judging yourself to be superior to others, that's a form of conceit. By which he meant self-conceiving. He said, if you consider yourself to be inferior to others, or somehow deeply flawed or unworthy, that is likewise conceit. It's self-conceiving. It's every bit as much conceit as thinking yourself better than others is, you know. Constantly judging, constantly comparing self to others. So the Buddha's idea of, you know, sort of positive self-regard is doing neither, but rather simply recognizing we're all in this together, that whenever we self-conceive, whether it's conceiving ourselves to be better than or worse than, it's still self-conceiving. It's still creating suffering. Okay. So this notion of a healthy sense of self is one that neither condemns the other or condemns oneself, okay, but simply realizes that personality, as an early Buddhist teacher, Nagasena, famously said, you know, the personality is kind of like a, or the self, it's sort of like a vehicle. You know, we use it to get from here to there. We use it to get a social security number and an education and a job and a place to live. And, you know, these are all useful things, right? So it can perform a useful function. It's just that we ask it to do much more than it's capable of. And we try to believe it to be something that it's not. You know, so as long as we can, as when we see ourselves self-fabricating, right? If we're doing it for the simplest of reasons, you know, filling out a job application or whatever, and then they want to know your degrees and all this, that, and the other thing, you're trying to, you know, convey a positive impression, fine. You do that so you can get your job, hopefully telling the truth, right? But doing so with the understanding that that's not who you truly are. You know, the information on the job description is not who you are. You know, it's a convenience, it's a construct that you put together to achieve a certain objective. So if we can think of the self in that way, it's a very different take than believing that what we see on the job application is actually who we are. So I'm hoping that something I've said may have sparked some interest or a question or a comment, so now's a good time to share them, if you want, please.
So, if that's not who we are, who are we? If that's not who we really are.
Who are we really?
Who are we really?
So you really want the answer?
let me plug my ears first.
Who we are is the asker of the question. How's that? Chew on that answer for a minute. I mean, really. What do you think?
Well, it sounds a bit like a poem.
Yes. It is indeed. The asking of the question, right? People are asking the Buddha all the time, what happens when you die, right? And what was his answer usually? Why do you ask? Why do you ask? The reason being that he's trying to turn the attention to that activity of mind that wants there to be. either wants to know, yes, oh yes, yes, there's many lifetimes, you live it over, don't worry about it, you know. Or, nope, this is it, you're a goner, you know, go out and wreak havoc, it doesn't matter, you're good, you know. Which is not what he said, not at all what he said, okay. If we think of ourselves only as gerunds, you know, as verbs, rather than as nouns, it's very helpful. You know? That's a lot of what anatta is all about. You know? We begin to train the mind to not think of ourselves as entities, but rather as processes. Just like a snowstorm, you know, a temporary coming together of elements and conditions that manifest as a certain thing. Okay. And that's all that we are too, you know. The path of the one who is follower of the Buddha is to seek to manifest with wisdom and kindness. Generosity, moment to moment to moment, instead of manifesting, you know, as one imbued with, you know, delusion and, what are the other two? Delusion, attachment, and aversion. Right, right. So, let me get back to this document. In the Mahayana tradition, there's something called the Bodhisattva path. Bodhisattvas, as understood in the tradition, are people who've gone around cycles of rebirth over and over again, okay, becoming more wise, more attuned, more insightful into how to live a life that helps the cessation of suffering to occur rather than the perpetuation of suffering. Okay. In this understanding, the cycles of rebirth for the most part are involuntary. You know, and somebody asked, Trungpa Rinpoche one time, what gets reborn? And he said, your bad habits. Ways you messed up are going to cause you to have to come around again and figure out, you must be born again and again and again until you get it right, you know, until you kind of suss it out. The idea behind the Bodhisattva is that they have come to the point of purification where they see the path to ultimate liberation and they understand that they can step off the wheel and don't, you know, attain ultimate enlightenment and not have to get reborn again. But they choose rebirth in order to assist other sentient beings and likewise coming to a state of enlightenment. Okay. And so one way to understand, at least from the Mahayana perspective, what it means to live from a place of not-self, okay, is this path of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva vow takes different forms in different traditions. Here's one of them. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So these are all things that the egoistic mind is incapable of doing, right? So it's saying that coming from a place of not-self, beings are numberless, I vow to save them all, right? Which of course is impossible. Desires are inexhaustible, I vow to end them, right? So in other words, break the link of craving that causes involuntary rebirth. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Talking here about understandings of the Dharma. Access to, you know, deep insight into the nature of self, non-self in the Buddha's teaching. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. You know, but basically vow to become a Buddha. So that's, you know, initially here in the West, that was the Bodhisattva Vow, very inspirational, big hit, still is, you know, for a lot of people. And then it also became apparent to some Dharma teachers that it was driving people nuts, that they would take the vow, but they weren't really taking it from a place of not self. They really were trying to save everybody. They really were trying to, you know, become a Buddha in this time. They really were trying to, you know, end all craving, which they found to be impossible. Kōpin Roshi, who is the founder of the Tassajara Zen Center at Suzuki Roshi's request, you know, another teacher in his lineage, he came up with an alternative version of the Bodhisattva vow. And it reads like this: sentient beings are numberless. They will save themselves. Delusions are inexhaustible. They will end by themselves. Dharma gates are boundless. They will open continuously. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to allow it. So he's hanging with the same intention, but he's trying to relax this kind of tense relationship with the Bodhisattva vow. You know, the way that the Bodhisattva vow can wreak havoc is if it is taken from a stance of self. You know, I am going to achieve these things, right? You know, what he's trying to do is to say, of course, these are all wonderful aspirations. Allow them to occur. Okay, allow yourself to be a bodhisattva rather than forcing yourself to try to conform to some idea of what it is to be a holy person. Okay. Make friends with yourself, right? So that's really ultimately the only path, you know, that if you are going forth using any aspect of the Buddha's teachings as a cudgel against yourself, you will only do tremendous harm, and you will have missed the point entirely, you know, until at some point you realize, wow, this really hurts. This is dukkha. This is the mind clinging to some notion of what it means to be a spiritual seeker, or what it means to be a bodhisattva for that matter. And once you see that, and you can cease doing it, and you can offer yourself some compassion for having had to learn this painful lesson, and accepting everything that you are, all of it, love your crooked neighbor with all your crooked heart, you know, just once you can open to the entirety of who we are, including the things that really bug us, you know, doesn't mean keep doing the things that we know to be unskillful, but simply to be able to open to those aspects of us that, given the power, would lead us in an unwholesome direction. Just recognizing they're there, you know, that disempowers them, just the recognition, okay? So please, more reflection, please.
You talk about, I love how you talked about meetingness, that you become a person who needs, right? At least you have before. And so the question is, we do have needs, right? Like, one of those needs is to be with other people.
Absolutely.
So can you just speak to how you navigate that?
Sure, sure. You know, the motivational psychologist Abraham Maslow, in his book Motivation and Personality, talks about this hierarchy of needs. You know, first the need just for nourishment, for shelter, for the meeting the basic necessities of existence, physical existence. The need for safety and security, to be free from harm. Okay. The need for a sense of belongingness, of being in contact with others, okay? Not only to be in contact with others, but to be positively regarded, you know, need for esteem, self-esteem, esteem from others, right? And then the next need was self-actualization, right? And he had quite an impact on the field of psychology at around the same time the Dharma was coming to the West. Okay? And I think for a lot of us who were studying both those teachings at the same time, they really fit together very nicely. And Dharma teachers like Jack Kornfield and others who are also psychotherapists say, well, you know, one of the real problems that would arise with yogis who would come on retreat and they would start talking about, you know, oh, sort of being empty of self and whatnot, and this, and you know, this is my path, and I've given up all these cravings and whatnot. A lot of times, he saw that these were people really in a fair amount of trouble, because they had some pretty deep, completely unmet needs that they were not acknowledging. You know, that they were looking for the Dharma as a substitute for, you know, work that needed to be done in the realm of some really troubled childhood or something of that nature, or real problems with interpersonal relationships or whatever. So instead, there's this view that to be able to mature spiritually really necessitates being a whole healthy person in all those realms. So if you do feel a felt need for like sort of more social contact, you know, the Buddha said, seek out wise friends, you know, seek out the company of people who bring out the best in you, right? Just as you seek to bring out the best in them. That's one of the crucially important aspects of Sangha, for instance. You know, absolutely make sure that your basic needs are met. You know, unless you're a monastic or something, you're out there in the world. Absolutely. Because the whole bottom line here is compassion for and care for all sentient beings, including yourself. So assessing what your needs are and seeking to meet them, because if you have unmet needs, you're not really able to be of, you know, much service to anybody else, or at least it limits your ability. That helpful? Yes. Yeah. Okay. So please.
I have a question, because not Western psychologist, but Jung's teachings was, the root teachings of Maya Gertz was from Jung. And I felt like I finally found out I'm an intuitive, not to put myself in a box, but there's an essence of personality that, or if you're introverted, that seemed to be a part of who we are too, and I always struggled with not self because of that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Essence of Lloyd. What would you say to that?
Well, one of my favorite Jung quotes, I have to paraphrase it because I can't remember it verbatim, is that enlightenment is achieved not by imagining visions of light in heaven, but by examining the darkness. You know, the latter path, he said, however, is difficult and therefore unpopular. But yeah, he was all about examining what's in the shadows, you know, and there he was speaking very directly to the deluded state of mind. He was saying that the power of, and when he spoke of delusion, he spoke of it in very much the same way the Buddha did. You know, ignorance is not a passive lack of knowledge or information. It's an active state of mind. It's the mind that does not wish to apprehend, the mind that does not wish to see something. And so for him, anyone that's studied his writings or whatever, a lot of his emphasis was on, what is it the mind doesn't want to see and why? You know, let's go there. Let's go see what it is that the mind doesn't want to look at, you know. That's where the good stuff is. That's where the growth lies, you know. That's straight up Dharma. The Buddha said we choose not to see things for a reason, right? But that's where the freedom lies. Yeah.
a shorter version of that was, unless you embrace your alligators, they'll bite you in the ass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something along those lines, yes. Other views, questions? Very well then, my friends. Let's settle in for just one last moment. May we live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm. May we embrace our inner darkness just as we embrace the outer light. May we be free of all physical and mental suffering. May we be a kind host to any physical or mental suffering that we find within us. Treat it with courage and with caring and with kindness. May we be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May we rest in silence and stillness, at peace with things as they are. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free. Have a safe journey home, everyone.